It's August 2014, and Ferguson, Missouri is on fire.
And all of the networks were talking about this black rage, you know, and it was like looking at this spectacle of black rage. And I had lived in Missouri for 13 years. I saw that thing. I saw how it worked. And I found myself shaking my head. No. And I went, no, this is white rage.
That's Carol Anderson. We spend the hour with her talking about her best-selling book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. It won the National Book Critics Circle Award, among many others. This is Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. If you read the great African-American poet Langston Hughes's poem, A Dream Deferred, ask yourself, is he talking about black rage or white rage? Of course, you'll probably answer black rage. After all, Langston Hughes asks, what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode? But listen again to the first line, what happens to a dream deferred? And ask yourself, why have the dreams of black people in America been systematically deferred? Why are black people still having to assert that black lives matter? Why do we have a president whose one overriding policy goal is to undo everything our first black president accomplished before him? The answer is in my guest Carol Anderson's groundbreaking book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. She proves again and again what should be obvious, but what our society always seems to overlook. Since 1865 and the passage of the 13th Amendment, every time African Americans have made advances toward full participation in our democracy, white reaction has fueled a relentless rollback of their gains. Why do white people get so angry at the idea of black people having rights? Anderson's book, White Rage, is a powerful indictment of white racism, especially as it has been expressed in our institutions from the courts to the press. The book is also freighted with grief at the terrible waste of lives and possibility that racism has cost not just our black citizens, but our society as a whole. White Rage is a book that should be required reading in every high school and for every politician, indeed for every public servant. I'm glad so many have agreed, as the book has won numerous prestigious awards. Carol Anderson is professor of African American Studies at American University. In addition to White Rage, she's the author of Eyes Off the Prize and Bourgeois Radicals. Carol Anderson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Francesca. I really appreciate it.
This book, White Rage, first I want to say right away that it is a powerfully written book. Powerful because it really delves into the history of a phenomenon that has been so ingrained in our national culture that, and yet so unseen by so many who haven't been the immediate victims of it. You know, the issue of racial strife is always framed in terms of black rage, from the Black Power days of Stokely Carmichael to Black Lives Matter today. You say this entirely misses the point.
Entirely. Absolutely entirely. And in fact, the book emerged. It started ruminating with the killing of Amadou Diallo and listening to Rudy Giuliani, the mayor of New York, being absolutely clinical in his description of a policy that was working because crime is down in New York. And this is juxtaposed to these kinds of visual images of black people protesting the killing of an unarmed man who is gunned down in a hail of 41 bullets by the NYPD. And so I started thinking through this, but I couldn't quite name the thing, the phenomenon. And as a scholar, I'm continuing to research and I'm continuing to write. And then August 2014 came, and Ferguson, Missouri is on fire. And all of the networks were talking about this black rage, you know, it was like looking at this spectacle of black rage. And I had lived in Missouri for 13 years. I saw that thing. I saw how it worked. And I found myself shaking my head. No. And I went, no, this is white rage. And then I went, oh, this is white rage. And as I said, we have been so focused in on the flames that we have missed the kindling.
Yes, exactly. That's a powerful image that you create. And the white rage, what is the trigger? What is the cause of white rage?
The trigger is African-American advancement and achievement and African-Americans' refusal to accept anything but first-class citizenship. If black people are quiet and subjugated, it's fine. But in these key moments where you see African Americans achieving, gaining access to their citizenship rights, fighting so hard for it, there is a wave of policies that emerge that are designed to absolutely undercut that advancement. And it sounds counterintuitive. Because, you know, this is the land of opportunity, the land where if you work hard, if you achieve, if you aspire, this is the space where all is possible. But it's not. And that's what white rage zeroes in on. We, as a nation, we think of racism only as throwing around the N-word and the Klan and a cross-burning. But watching the way that Supreme Court decisions in the most legalistic, clinical, seemingly logical way eviscerate the rights of African Americans, the way that policies coming out of Congress, out of school boards, do the same thing, that's where the focus of this book is.
It's on the systematic use and expression of white rage. You know, I want to start with Obama, actually, because...
Mm-hmm. That's a great place to start, because this is raw right now.
Exactly. You know, you say he was the ultimate affront. And in fact, the Republican response to Obama, I mean, we know how Donald Trump is, you know, systematically undoing every single positive bit of Obama's legacy, although there are some negative parts of Obama's legacy that he's happy to keep in place.
Yeah. Can't help the breeze.
Yeah, exactly. But that the Republicans actually, there was a Republican who actually said, we're not generating enough angry white guys to mm-hmm. stay in power.
Yes. Lindsey Graham, Senator out of South Carolina, said that. Part of it, what you see is that the Republican Party brought into its fold via the Southern Strategy. That's why I love the history of it, because if we understand the history of it, we understand that Donald Trump is not some aberrant phenomenon, but he is basically the culmination of years, decades of tilling in this ground of white rage. In 68, Richard Nixon decided on the Southern Strategy, and that was to lure, to entice, to woo into the Republican Party the Southern Democrats, as well as white ethnic groups in the Northeast and in the Midwest, who were absolutely disaffected, who were operating under the fear that the gains that African Americans had made in the civil rights movement could only come at their expense. And so you saw the kinds of dog whistles that Nixon used, law and order, in order to send the signal that his government, his administration, would work to curtail all of these civil rights advances. So there is a coursing through the Southern strategy is anti-civil rights, anti-blackness. If we understand that, then we understand that they lured this toxin into the Republican Party, and that toxin took over. This explains why it was so difficult then in a field of 16 for the Republican senators and governors who were vying for president to actually outdo someone who brought to the table no governmental experience whatsoever, who brought to the table no policy understanding whatsoever, but who did bring pure, unadulterated, unvarnished white supremacy. He played to that base in just such horrific ways, from Mexicans are rapist to, you know, black hell holes, playing on that sense of a black dystopia that's a threat to America, and America is coded white. And what he brought to the table was a type of anti-Obamaism with his birther crusade that distinguished him in terms of the virulence of his racism from the other candidates.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Carol Anderson about her groundbreaking best-selling book, White Rage. You know, you call him a white supremacist, and I would agree with you. I mean, I think it was made pretty clear, Charlottesville, and with the people that he's put into his cabinet. Well, some of them are out of the cabinet now, but that's not because he's rejected white supremacy. But you pointed that white supremacy is viewed in our supposedly post-racial society, or what was thought of as post-racial when Obama got elected, as the sole definition of racism. But in fact, that's not true.
No, absolutely. One of the key linguistic tricks that happened after the civil rights movement was to define racism solely in this very narrowed band of the KKK, of cross burnings. And so when we had policies, and I'll take a key policy, for instance, that emerged out of Obama's victory, which is voter suppression. It looks clinical. They use the language of protecting democracy. They use language of protecting the integrity of the ballot box by stopping rampant voter fraud. And so that kind of language cloaks what is clearly a racist policy designed to disfranchise African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, and the poor. And at first it sounds like, yeah, right. And then the way white rage works, because that veneer of legality, of respectability, gives it cover, gives it a shield. But you pull it back and you see how the policy operates. And there's this moment where you know you are looking into the abyss. So, for instance, let's take Alabama. Alabama used the language of protecting the integrity of the ballot box from voter fraud and then required government-issued photo ID in order to register and to vote. Then what Alabama did, because remember, government-issued photo ID, was to then constrict which types of government-issued photo ID counted. And off the table immediately was public housing ID. Now, public housing, that would be government-issued photo ID. But what Alabama wanted was to say, no, this is one of the ways to get rid of the poor, and this is one of the ways to get rid of poor Latinos and poor blacks. Then Alabama said, what we're going to do is the holy grail, really, for photo ID is a driver's license or a state-issued ID, which you get out of the Department of Motor Vehicles. Then the state shut down the Department of Motor Vehicles in what are called the Black Belt counties, those counties that went for Obama in the 2008 election, and those counties that have a sizable black population. They are also the counties that have somewhere between a 25% to a 40% poverty rate. So if you shut down the Department of Motor Vehicles, you don't have public transportation. You will not allow public housing ID. How are people supposed to go two counties, three counties over who don't drive in order to get the driver's license that they need in order to exercise their right to vote?
Yeah, and, you know, I can imagine some people saying, well, don't they have their birth certificates?
Okay, so that's where, again, this is where it provides that clean veneer of looking commonsensical, really. Many poor and many of the elderly poor were not born in hospitals. They don't have the birth certificate. And what it takes to get that cost, I would say, a significant amount of money, particularly if you're poor. So, for instance, in Wisconsin, a man was born in Illinois. It took him almost $400. It cost almost $400 for all of the paperwork and everything that it took in order to get his birth certificate, in order for him then to have proof of identity, in order to get the driver's license. Now, when you begin to think about 40% of your population lives below the federal poverty line, what $400 would be, it's enormous. One woman said, I see the groceries are getting my birth certificate. I can't eat a birth certificate. But that's how they structure the laws. And it's the way, it's similar to the kinds of disfranchisement that happened with the poll tax that came up with the rise of Jim Crow in the 1890s, which was a clear response, again, to African Americans voting and African American citizenship coming out of the Civil War.
Yeah, and actually, I think this would be a great time to delve into the history, which you do, and you start from slavery, and you go into the history from slavery to today. But I'd like to start at Reconstruction and the counter-revolution to it. How was virtual slavery reinstituted in the South after the Civil War?
One of the first moves was by President Andrew Johnson, who came to power after Lincoln's assassination. And Andrew Johnson was a former slaveholder, and he believed that the war was all about keeping the United States united. It was not about slavery as far as he was concerned. So he provided nothing in terms of support for the newly freed. But what he did provide, though, was amnesty for the Confederate leadership. So for the people who attacked the United States and tried to destroy it, he provided amnesty, which then gave them the ability to come back into power in 1865. So, you know, it's almost like the flames of the war are still smoldering, right? The embers are still smoldering. And the folks who had started this war are now back in power in the South. And as they start instituting their new constitutions, like Louisiana said, ours has been and will always be a government for white people. Those of African descent can never be citizens. And on that basis, they began to institute the Black Codes. And the Black Codes required African Americans to sign a labor contract, an annual labor contract, that tied them to that one employer. If they refused to sign, they could be arrested for vagrancy, and then their labor auctioned off to the highest bidder.
So like slavery, in other words.
Exactly. And the black codes had things in there such as African Americans could basically only work in agriculture or as domestics. They could not work in any other field. So during slavery, if someone had mastered the skill, say, of being a blacksmith, that was not a skill that that person would then be able to use in the post-Civil War moment, unless a judge or a mayor signed off that that person, that newly freed person would be able to do that. So it was to reconstitute an agricultural workforce tied to an employer, but this time with a wonderfully wicked layer of using the criminal justice system as a means to absolutely enforce African Americans continuing to work in the fields. And think about how that is so disruptive of what we understand as a capitalist economy, where you can take your labor to the employer who has the best conditions, the best wages, the best working conditions, but this absolutely short-circuits that.
Yeah, and there's a link to mass incarceration. Even though mass incarceration is seen as something that started, let's say, in the 70s or 80s, really in the South, it began with the black codes.
It began with the black codes. The linking of blackness with criminality, particularly, I mean, it started earlier in the North, but it gripped and seized the moment after the Civil War because there had to be a way to put all of this black labor back under the subjugation of white planters, white owners, white businessmen. And it had to do so in a way that stripped African Americans of their rights, because you had this battle happening after the Civil War between President Johnson and what were called the Radical Republicans. I mean, and I know that term sounds so, like, wild now, right? Radical Republicans. But the Radical Republicans fought for what are called the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, and the 15th Amendment. The 13th ended slavery. The 14th provided citizenship for those born in the United States. And the 15th provided the right to vote. And at the time, that was for men. And so the thought was 13th, 14th, and 15th ought to do it. But then it's watching the way that the Supreme Court, in a series of decisions, systematically undercut the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, pushed all power back onto the states that saw themselves, that their role was to continue to enslave black people, and watch the federal government abdicate all responsibility for ensuring the rights of American citizens.
And in fact, they used the justification of strict constitutionalism, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And, you know, this really struck me because the first time I heard of strict constitutionalism was in context of the current right-wing Republican members of the current Supreme Court.
Yes, yes. And so, again, if you think about that original Constitution and see how beautiful that language sounds. Well, of course, the original Constitution, and it's supposed to stir up this sense of super patriotism. But that original Constitution, for instance, said that African Americans in the South could be counted as 3/5 of a human being in terms of the number of representatives that a state could have. So it was a way to provide additional voting strength and power for the slave states in the U.S. Congress without providing the rights that African Americans were supposed to have. And you see so much of that today. The issue of that's before the court right now in terms of gerrymandering, that really is about that you've got representation based on the number of the population you have in a state. So that's how many representatives you have. But then if you carve the rules just right, you've basically created that a sizable part of that population is just 3/5 of a human being. So that you get the numbers that they bring, but they don't get the representation that they deserve.
Yeah, now it's Democrats who are three-fifths of a person in a way.
Yeah.
And you know, this is really important because this is coming up against the whole issue of gerrymandering is coming before the Supreme Court. And
yes.
I have not heard very much analysis from the media. You know, it's almost assumed that, well, they're going to consider this in all due deliberation and the sober, you know, the sober mm-hmm. judge and all that. And I'm thinking, wait a second, this court is really hanging on a thread in terms of rights. What do you think might happen if you would venture a guess?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I've been following it closely. My hope is that the folks who are there are reading the tea leaves correctly and that Justice Kennedy is leaning toward the side of the liberals on the court. So we all end up with a 5-4 decision. But you heard Chief Justice John Roberts, who does not like voting rights, basically saying that the social science used to demonstrate that the way that the Republicans drew the districts was absolutely rigged. He said, oh, that's gobbledygook. You heard Gorsuch, who really should not be there because that was Merrick Garland's seat. You hear Gorsuch being absolutely dismissive and saying, using that language, well, where in the Constitution does it say? And that's when I loved Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg then turning and saying, okay, so how did we get to one person, one vote? And that was a Supreme Court decision in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement.
Wow.
Yes.
That late.
Yes. Yes.
Now, I wonder if you could put the counter-revolution against Reconstruction, the Black Codes, I mean, which were incredibly brutal, enforced with violence, not just with imprisonment. Put that into the context of the current battle over Confederate monuments. And what I mean here is, you know, on the one hand, you've got the president saying, well, these are our traditions. On the other people, you know, why are people so intent, you know, on saying, wait, we don't want these monuments up?
I look at it this way, is that when you think about what the Confederacy stood for, and so you get a lot of whitewashing. You get a lot of historical amnesia. You get a lot of shell games happening where it's like, this is just our heritage. How are you denying our heritage? You know, this is about states' rights. And I say, a heritage to do what? The state's right to do what? And it is to own human beings. This was a war fought to own human beings, to buy them, to breed them, to rape them, to murder them. And I've just got to say the one other piece that which tells you the strength of white supremacy in this nation is this was a war designed to destroy the United States. You had a group of states attack the U.S. and sought to break it in two. These are traitors. So we have, because of the power of the myth, we have put traitors in the middle of our public spaces in a place of honor.
You know, I'm Jewish, and to me, what I was thinking was like, if there were a statue honoring Hitler, you know, would people think, well, you know, that's just in honor of the German ancestry of so many of our American citizens. No, it's not.
No, exactly. Exactly. Those monuments sent the signal to blacks in those areas that this is who we honor, not you. This is who we value, not you. And if we really had our way, you know, how many times do you hear the South shall rise again?
Mm.
And we saw that in Charlottesville. And in Charlottesville, where the neo-Nazis and the Klan and the ultimate right wing are marching for some kind of white rights, this is ours, we're protecting Robert E. Lee, and they kill a woman in the process. And the president of the United States says there were some mighty fine people.
Carol Anderson. After the break, we'll talk more with her about her best-selling book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Stick around. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour today talking with Carol Anderson about her best-selling book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. It says that gains by black people in civil rights or basic social justice have always been followed by white rage and relentless attempts to roll back those gains. Then let's go on to the Great Migration, because this is also something I had no idea about. Of course, most of us know about the Great Migration, but what we don't know is how bitterly the southern states tried to shut that migration down, actually trying to stop the trains themselves, taking tickets out of people's hands.
And again, it is so... I mean, it is so jarring to our narrative of America. The narrative is that we are a people who move where the opportunities are. You know, it is the narrative of the Statue of Liberty. It is the narrative of westward expansion. It is the narrative. And so here you have African Americans who are facing massive disfranchisement, who are facing lynching at an average of one every other day for a decade, who are facing the lack of quality schools for their children, where in many cases, because the schools are segregated, black schools don't open until after the harvest is in. So you're looking sometime in November. So not only a very truncated school year, but also one that does not provide the resources. And so black parents are looking for opportunities. They're looking to be paid a living wage. They're looking for good schools. They're looking for decent housing. And they're looking to not be lynched. This is some of the basic stuff here. And what World War I did was it created a massive need for labor in the war industries in the North. And particularly because many of the European immigrants who had been workers in those factories, many had returned home to fight for their country. And so labor agents from the North are coming down south because they're like, oh, my gosh, we've got a lot of black people down there. And they start bringing black people north. The South, now remember, I've talked about lynching. I've talked about unequal schools. I've talked about, you know, the South is like, no, you can't leave. Now, that sounds like what? But you had places in Florida and Georgia that are passing laws forbidding African Americans to leave in order to get better employment.
And when we talk about better employment, you have one figure, you know, a worker in a factory during World War II up north could make maybe $5 a day, which would be equivalent to what he could make in several months?
Yes.
In the South?
Yes. I used to say, this is in the land of, this really isn't hard. You know, that when you're looking at what a Henry Ford is paying up in Detroit, compared to what a sharecropper has to deal with, and there are stories, horrific stories, for instance, of sharecroppers because, you know, they have to do everything on credit. And then when the harvest is in, then they get paid their share of the cash minus everything they had to purchase on credit and minus the seed, et cetera. At the end of working for months on end, waiting to get paid, one, they would the planters would rig the books and so say, nope, you don't have anything coming to you because you spent so much. That, in fact, you owe us. So when you start working here next year, you're going to be in the hole. It was a way of debt slavery. what you also had, sometimes they wouldn't get paid cash. They would get paid, you know, Owen Whitfield out of Missouri talked about getting, and he's got a slew of kids, getting paid with an old, worn-out, threadbare suit. That's what the farm owner, in fact, handed him as his payment for sharecropping. You can't feed your children on a suit. So, yes, folks were going north. But between the laws that were getting passed, they were also passing laws saying that the labor agents who were coming down recruiting African Americans would have to pay a licensing fee. And in one of those places, the licensing fee was equivalent to $25,000.
You know, on the one hand, as I was reading your book, and I'm just going to share this as a, you know, kind of the mindset that we have, I kept on thinking, well, but this book is about white rage, you know, but what I'm reading about is oppression. And then I said, no, wait a second, the oppression comes out of white rage.
Yes, yes, yes. Because I wanted, again, to make it so clear that as long as we continue to define this rage as either the Klan burning a cross, and so you saw there was all kinds of angst about Charlottesville. But there wasn't the same kind of angst, for instance, that at the same time, the Secretary of State here in Georgia purged over 500,000 voters off of the rolls.
Oh, my God. And disproportionately,
yes,
African American.
Mm.
Now, you mentioned Detroit. Things were not exactly rosy in the North, although, you know, in comparison, they were better. Talk about the case of Henry Sweet and his wife in Detroit.
Ossian Sweet, and Henry was his brother. So Ossian Sweet was a physician in Detroit, and in fact, his story models our narrative of the American dream. He comes out of a very poor family out of Florida, impoverished, but he works really hard. He keeps his nose clean. He goes to school. He ends up at Howard University, gets his medical degree, and starts a practice in Detroit. And he has a wife and a new baby. All of this is reading like the American dream, right? The narrative. But Detroit has blocked off where black people can live into an area called Black Bottom. And it is a tight area. And with the Great Migration, the population in Black Bottom swelled by 10 times the number that was originally there. So imagine the population can't expand geographically, but is then locked into an area that is now teeming with 10 times the number of people. Worse yet, only 25% of the homes in Black Bottom had indoor plumbing. And this is in the 1920s, in the North. And so Ossian Sweet is going, I'm not raising my baby like this. And again, this is a narrative we understand. And so he goes and he's looking for a home to buy, and he purchases one on Garland Avenue, which is in a white working class neighborhood. He's not at Grosse Pointe. He's in a home where, in a neighborhood with factory workers, you know, pipe fitters, welders, plumbers, and he's a physician. But it's, for him, it is a beautiful home. A white homeowners association forms when Ossian Sweet buys this house. And that homeowners association was determined, as they had before in other white neighborhoods in Detroit, to drive the black homeowner out and drive them back into Black Bottom. So here's one where your credentials don't matter, your class doesn't matter. All that matters is the blackness of your skin. And it's one where your property rights don't matter. A mob forms around Ossian Sweet's home as he's moving in, and he has his brother in there and his wife and some friends. He also has an arsenal with him because it has been clear in previous episodes that white Detroiters will use violence to drive black people out. And he knows that he has the right to protect his property and his life. Self-defense. As the mob starts throwing rocks and shattering the windows in his home, the Sweets pull out their guns and start firing into the crowd to drive the mob back. Now, Ossian Sweet, before this happened, when he knew that the mob was coming, he called the police to get some protection. The police did come, but then they sat there watching the mob form. They sat there listening to the epithets. They sat there as the rocks are pummeling the house, shattering the windows. It was only when the Sweets fought back and two white men went down, one was killed, that the police moved in. But they didn't move in on the mob. They moved in on the Sweets and arrested them for murder. Everybody in that house, handcuffed and jailed. Now, this looks simple. A mob attacks your house. They're on your yard. They're shattering your windows. You get to protect yourself. Not in this case, not in Detroit. The newspapers. And so that was what was fascinating for me working on this book, was looking at what the norms are, what the scripts are for all of these entities, and then seeing the way that white rage has just twisted them. So there were three newspapers in Detroit at the time. One ran with the story that the mob only attacked after the Sweets fired into them, and that it really wasn't a mob quite anyway. Another newspaper just picked up that same story and ran with it. But the third newspaper in Detroit had a reporter who just happened to be on the ground there. He was driving around. He saw a group of whites forming. He's like, what is going on here? He gets out of his car. He sees the mob. He hears the epithets. He sees the rocks. He sees the windows being shattered. He sees the cops just sitting there, just chilling. And then he hears the gunfire. He has the story. He has the true story. He's breaking the story. And you think about what we think of journalism is that when you have the story of the day, when you have the scoop, then you can bring it. He writes that story up. His editor looks at it and basically says, I don't care if that's what's happened. We're running with the traditional story that the Sweets fired on the mob, and only then did the mob throw the rocks.
We're talking with Carol Anderson about her groundbreaking, best-selling book, White Rage. You know, another thing that was interesting about this case is that the prosecutor, now remember the prosecutor who was prosecuting the Sweets for murder, went on later on to be a prosecutor in the Nuremberg trials.
I found that, you know, it was one of those things where it kind of rocks you back on your heels. Because after the first trial, when it's a hung jury, the fact that he came back to prosecute them again, even when it became really clear that the evidence, that everybody, the police were lying, the neighbors were lying, that this was a case built on lies and racism, he even went back again to try them for murder. And I went, Nuremberg? Wow.
Exactly.
Wow.
Now, you mentioned education and just how terrible education was in the South. And a whole chapter of your book, Carol Anderson, of White Rage, is about the fierce resistance to the decision of Brown versus Topeka, Kansas Board of Education, a policy of stall and deny. How did that play out?
So the first thing was that, you know, the NAACP went after the Plessy v. Ferguson decision, which was separate but equal, the decision of 1896, which basically gave Supreme Court sanction to Jim Crow. The problem was is that the states immediately moved on separate. That word they understood. pen moves like boom on it and separated everything. The word they couldn't quite wrestle with was equal. And the massive disparities were so apparent. And that was the Achilles heel that the NAACP attorneys attacked. When Brown came down, the South had already begun to map out what they would do if the decision did not go in its favor. Part of what they would do was to institute a harsher wave of disfranchisement. Because if black people can't vote, then that will ensure that the people who are coming to power in those states, like Mississippi, will be ardent segregationists who will do everything in their power to make sure that Brown never gets implemented. The next thing they did was, and there's just a special kind of evil in this, is that they worked on how to shut down the public school system. And the rationale behind that was, if we've got to have equal schools, then we do, because now nobody has a public school system. Kind of like, ha-ha. But, of course, they know that white parents aren't going to go for that. Black parents aren't going to go for that, but they don't care about black parents. So what they did for white parents was then they took tax dollars, and those are also the tax dollars that black people are paying, and used that to provide tuition waivers or to pay the tuition for white students to continue their education at all white segregated private academies. So white children continue to be educated, but now this time in private schools, paid for by public dollars. Black children, on the other hand, had nothing. One of the most egregious examples of this was Prince Edward County in Virginia. And we often don't think of Virginia as being as, say, rabid as Mississippi. But Virginia took the lead in what is called massive resistance. In Prince Edward County, they shut down the public school systems. White children went to all-white private academies. Prince Edward County was shut down for 5 years. I describe it as, imagine you're in the fifth grade and your school shuts down and you don't have a school to go to until you're in the 10th grade. And begin to think about everything you have lost and how far behind you are. Thousands of black children in the Prince Edward County school were just in that position. And after it became clear that stall and defy would not quite work, then the South instituted what I call stall and undermine. Dragging their feet in terms of implementing Brown, finding new clever ways and words such as freedom of choice plans. And that's why, again, I pay attention to the language. In America, we love freedom. In America, we love choice. So if you have a freedom of choice plan, this must be the all-American plan. Except what it is designed to do is to allow white parents to move their children out of schools, and I'll put this in quotes, that are threatened with integration, so that you can then reconstitute all black schools without saying you're reconstituting all black schools. They also had what they called the student placement plan, which allowed the school board to individually vet each student. Like in Arkansas, after Little Rock and after the schools are shut down, after they're forced to reopen, what the school board, and these are the moderates, what they figure out is what we can do is put a handful of black students in these white schools. That will be enough to satisfy the federal government, but there won't be enough of them to be real integration, and there won't be enough of them to get the parents all upset. As I said, and this would leave the bulk of black children in their already segregated schools. That's what we did. And one of the pieces that I pull out there in the story on Brown, because to me it indicates how deeply entrenched this is the case of Sputnik. when in 1957, because you remember Brown 1 is 54, Brown 2 is 1955, and Brown 2 is the implementation decision with all deliberate speed. And in 1957, the Soviets launch a satellite up into space. This is the first indication for the United States that the Soviets are able to attach its nuclear arsenal to a missile that can easily cross the oceans and hit the United States. This is a national security crisis because the U.S. is now facing nuclear annihilation. The federal government says this is a national security crisis. We're going to do something we've never done before. We're going to pump hundreds of millions of dollars into state education, into state universities, to create the brain power to fight the Cold War, that we need to have enough scientists and engineers so that the U.S. can stay technologically ahead of the Soviet Union in order to provide for the United States' national security. This should be easy. One of the first things out of the mouths of the congressmen who are shepherding this landmark bill through was they wanted assurances that they would not have to implement Brown, that they could keep their universities all white, that they could deny admission to African Americans, to say to the University of Alabama, to Ole Miss, to Georgia, and defy federal law and still get federal dollars. And the federal government said yes. So even when faced with nuclear annihilation, the need to ensure that the Brown decision is not implemented, that black children do not have access to an education, and that black adults do not have access to the top universities in their states reigns supreme.
And let's point out that the impact is not just on black students, but on society as a whole, because it's a whole class of people who don't have the benefit of education, and society does not get the benefit of their ingenuity, their education. And in so many other ways, Carol Anderson, you also talk about how white rage undermines society for all of us. But we only have a little bit of time left, and so I wanted to ask you, we are in the midst of a racist backlash right now. I mean, we've had a huge increase in, you know, incidents of racial hatred, people being killed. We have a president who is a very clear, if he's not a white supremacist, he likes them a whole lot.
I think we're in the duck thing. Walks like, talks like, quacks like.
There you go, exactly. Yet there are some signs of hope that, unlike in previous times, more white people are getting involved in fighting against racism, as happened in Charlottesville.
Yes.
And you have the white coach of the San Antonio Spurs, Greg Popovich, calling out white privilege by saying, we still have no clue of what being born white means. I mean, he gave, I nearly, if I hadn't been driving my car, I would have fallen over. Listen to him. So talk a little bit about this time when we are in the midst of, you know, a resurgence of hatred and also a resurgence of resistance to that hatred that is even spilling over to white folks.
Yes, and that's, I've got to say, and that's where my hope is that there are millions of whites who don't want white rage. They don't want to be in a system governed by white rage. That resistance is real. Those are the folks. Remember after Charlottesville that there were over 700 cities that had anti-white supremacy rallies. That you have, they're calling in because they to their congressmen. They're sitting there, the Women's March, for instance. I talk about it in New York, where New Yorkers are on the subway. They look up, and there are all of these swastikas and all of these hate-filled words. And somebody said, well, you know, alcohol will take off a Sharpie. Somebody said, well, you know, I've got some hand wipes. And these New Yorkers are like, because it's like, I'm not living in this. That resistance to that racial hatred, that resistance to being in a society that is so skewed and so unequal that it destabilizes society. Whites are resisting that. And that is where the hope is, because you have African Americans, many African Americans, who are going, no. You have many Latinos going, no. You have many Asians going, no. And now you have many whites going, no. Now, what we know is that the push to keep this system so unequal and to keep it so racially driven is based on fear. And it is the fear that if minorities get, if black people get, if Latinos get, if Asians get, remember Steve Bannon said, we've got too many Asians in Silicon Valley. If they get, then it can only be at the expense of whites. It is to cast America as a zero-sum game. But as you said, when we look at the failure to invest in education for all of us, it has limited the ability of the United States to be all that it can be as a society. It has led us to have more folks who need additional assistance or who are without any assistance than being able to fully contribute to the growth and the vibrancy of this nation. Many whites are getting that. And that's why I think that I heard Trump saying with a bit of disdain, there's this thing called the resistance. And I was like, yeah. because it is shocking that all whites don't want to be in that kind of system. I don't think it's shocking. I think they got a taste of what is possible, and that they also don't want to raise their children in a society that is mean, nasty, and virulent. That's where our hope is.
And your book, Carol Anderson, White Rage, is such an important contribution to that consciousness. I mean, I really think this should be required reading for everyone in eighth grade up, because it's such a powerful book and just opens the mind, you know, strips away the mask, so that we can really see not only where we've been, but where we can also go, as
yes.
you said, that hope.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Carol Anderson is professor of African American Studies at American University. In addition to White Rage, she's the author of Eyes Off the Prize and Bourgeois Radicals. To read an excerpt from White Rage, go to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.